Tribal communities already dealing with poor healthcare are bracing for the impact of the pandemic.
I ordered our Parks and Recreation program to cease the sale of our buffalo in the event that we have to revert back to them as being our primary food source.
I'm Matt Katz, and this is The Takeaway for Thursday, April 2nd. Also this hour, we head to India, where a national lockdown has forced thousands of laborers to migrate back to their home villages.
They're attempting these journeys, risking their lives, because what they fear more is starving, not coronavirus.
And for one comedian, protecting his elderly parents from COVID-19 is a full-time job, and fodder for some online comedy.
If there's good behavior, I'll let them out for 20 minutes to walk around the backyard.
But first, COVID-19 and tribal communities. The coronavirus has been exposing and deepening systems of inequality all across the country. Low-wage workers without sick leave have limited options for making ends meet. Students without internet access are struggling as schools move online. And those without healthcare may be unable to seek help if they get sick. Adding on to that, nearly 10 million people in the U.S. have filed for unemployment in the past 2 weeks alone. In American Indian communities, the coronavirus outbreak has exposed a number of long-standing public health inequities. Some tribal leaders, like Rodney Bordeaux, the president of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota, have issued a state of emergency due to concerns over how the pandemic will affect their communities.
I'm troubled that our people do not currently have access to the CDC-approved test kits, either from the CDC or the Indian Health Service. I am also concerned that the state has not made available these tests for our people, especially our elders and our other vulnerable populations.
Urban Indian health programs, which were allocated some money in the recent stimulus package, have been underfunded for decades, despite the fact that roughly 70% of American Indians live in urban and suburban areas. I spoke with Francis Crevier of the National Council for Urban Indian Health about what the coronavirus outbreak has meant for urban Indian communities, and Julian Bear Runner, president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, about how it's affecting rural tribal populations. I first asked Julian Bear Runner, who also declared a state of emergency for his tribe, what the situation there is like and how he came to that decision.
The situation with the Indian Health Service here on the reservation, we have 6 respirators. We have a limited access to specialty care providers, which pushes us to send a lot of our membership off the reservation to surrounding areas within the state, as well as the state of Nebraska, for the special services that are needed. And it's a comprehensive healthcare facility, but they're very limited. They're underfunded. And equipment there is just, it's either not there or, not up to date. So, and we don't have the personnel there to operate some of the equipment. So, with assessing, the situation and, we have a housing shortage here on the reservation. We have up to, possibly 5 families living in one household. Being in such a rural area, we have a couple grocery stores here on the reservation. Just putting everything together, I deemed it, in an emergency state to be prepared as this virus, was spreading throughout the country.
You said you have 6 respirators. How many people on the reservation, and do you have any positive COVID cases just yet?
We have no positive COVID cases as of right now. However, we do have approximately 25,000 members living here on the reservation, and we have a total enrolled membership of 45,000, so half of them are currently living here on the reservation.
That means you're concerned that you face some serious challenges if there is an outbreak on the reservation.
Most definitely. If we have one person that contracts the virus and they return home, like I said, there's a possibility that they would contaminate 5 families, which could be 25 to 30 people. So if that was the case, and one thing is, we have a lot of elders, the medical conditions here on the reservation, a lot of our members are high risk, or they are diabetic. We have a lot of cardiac patients, patients on dialysis, asthma, You know, we have all these underlying health conditions that make us such a vulnerable group of people to this pandemic. So that was the reason being, you know, I mean, just weighing, you know, what we have, our capabilities of if just one household alone was to contract the virus, you know, this would just overwhelm our already overwhelmed system, you know, such as, you know, healthcare. And yeah, with our emergency medical services, our ambulance program is severely underfunded. We have only 5 ambulances that operate a little over 3 million acre land base. You know, and with IHS reporting back to the tribe that they were advised, you know, to cease ordering of the supplies because of the overwhelming demand, even, you know, raised a greater cause for concern.
Sure. Francis, let's zoom out a bit if we could. Can you give a sense of the national picture for urban Indian health? There are about 40 urban Indian health organizations. How have they functioned historically?
Those urban Indian organizations were created as part of the trust obligation when Congress had the relocation area and moved us off of reservations and into urban settings when they were under the Kill the Indian, Save the Man policy. And so those organizations are there to really help with healthcare for our Native people. And what happens, though, in the IHS system, the IHS system is severely underfunded. It's at less than $6 billion, and it should be at over $30 billion. And so the lack of resources is very, very apparent, and it's really hard right now because we are seeing a lot of cases in a lot of the urban areas as well as on reservations, on some reservations, and there's just not a lot of help right now. And so we're hopeful that starts soon, but there is a lot of need out there.
What else are you still asking for from the federal government?
I mean, we don't have personal protective gear. The whole IHS system does not. And so that has been a huge barrier. 2 of our facilities have had to shut down for lack of protective gear, and they're losing staff as they're being infected. And also, you know, with the Affordable Care Act, you know, there and I know the chairman's probably very familiar with this statement. IHS, they used to say before the Affordable Care Act that they will be don't get sick after June 1st because there won't be any funding to take care of you and facilities would shut down. And so we are starting to see that facilities are having to shut down. So we need Congress to give the tribes and the urban programs access to the national stockpile. We need them to really put a large investment into protecting our people. You know, we are one of the most impacted when it comes to the flu and access to healthcare. We do have high statistics in that. And so we need lots of funding and lots of resources to really help, as well as infrastructure items. I know that Congress is even discussing in the next package what the needs are for infrastructure. And the chairman just said there's only 6 respirators in IHS. So, and with telehealth being an issue, you know, now there needs to be a lot of support to help get all of our facilities up and running in the telehealth space. And so, you know, there's just a lot of investment that's needed. And in urban settings, this won't be a problem in terms of internet, but a lot of reservations don't have access to the internet.
Julian, beyond the medical care, how else have you been preparing for the outbreak so far in the reservation? I mean, is social distancing happening?
I issued an executive order suspending all travel, as well as a lockdown of our facilities, regards like our elder facilities. We have a nursing home that is operated by the Oglala Sioux tribe, to limit access to visitors, but also to try, we've been establishing Skype and other necessary means so that our relatives can still communicate with their elders in the nursing home. We also have another it's an elder facility that, you know, it's for those independent elders that you know, don't require special assistance. So we locked that facility down. I ordered our Parks and Recreation program to cease the sale of our buffalo in the event that we have to, you know, revert back to them as being our primary food source and supplier that, you know, since the beginning of time, you know, the buffalo has always provided everything that we needed. So my direction, I ceased the sale of buffalo. So just in the anticipation that if our store shelves were would be depleted, you know, that we have a means necessary to provide food for our people. you know, we also have our original way of life. Our ceremonies remind us that, you know, every hard time that we've ever faced as First Nations or as Lakota people, you know, our ceremonies are what got us through this.
You mentioned in there the importance of elders, and I was curious because coronavirus is especially deadly for the elderly from what we've seen so far, and I was hoping you could expand on that, about the role that elders play in your community and what it would mean to lose them from this virus.
Definitely, you know, they're our most vital group of people within our society or our tribe. We were always it was an oral teaching. You know, our history was never really written down. It was passed down through generation to generation. So, you know, they are our wisdom keepers. They hold that wisdom of our original and knowledge of our original songs, language, our way of life, our values. And so if they were to be impacted by this virus, you know, it would be very detrimental to the tribe, because we would lose all of that wisdom that they carry. So, you know, it's really difficult and it's really a struggle, but we're doing our best to ensure that we take those preventative measures to really secure them. And then, you know, sitting down, you know, some of our elders, they like to, you know, continue to do things on their own. They're very independent and don't, you know, they try not to rely on others for help. So with one of our meetings during this emergency declaration, you know, I asked IHS if they would set up a program here where our elders, if they wanted to come in or they needed to come in to get their medication, that and so it has been implemented that now if the elders can call a hotline or number at the hospital, and the pharmacist will actually bring the medication out to them in the parking lot so they don't have to go into the hospital. Then another thing was sitting down and going on the radio show and, you know, asking our people, you know, to take on a responsibility to, you know, reach out to their elders and, you know, see if they need things from the grocery store or things that require them to come out into society and try to take on that task for them, so that we, you know, we're doing our best. Because a lot of our elders, they don't want to reside in a facility. You know, they want to go to a nursing home or anything. You know, they want to remain at home. So, you know, trying to do our best to alleviate a lot of their hardships and their burdens that would cause them to come out into society or into the public.
The beauty of our communities is you're seeing what the chairman was referring to take care of our elders and step up and make a hotline and protect them. And that's what a lot of our communities are doing. But we definitely need access to what the mainstream has access to really make sure that our people are protected, and we can do that.
Julian Bear Runner is the president of Oglala Sioux Tribe in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and Frances Crevier is the executive director for the National Council for Urban Indian Health. Thank you both so much.
Yes, sir. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Across the country, hospitals are struggling to access the resources they need to care for their patients. Things like face masks, ventilators, ICU beds. But there's another aspect of healthcare that's also in short supply.
I define palliative care broadly as a medical specialty that focuses on the relief of suffering for patients and their families. We focus on treating the physical, emotional, and spiritual dimensions of suffering that come for anybody experiencing a serious illness.
Sunitha Puri is the medical director of palliative medicine at the Keck Hospital and Norris Cancer Center of the University of Southern California. She's also the author of That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. At Sunitha's hospital, the palliative care team is made up of people from different disciplines, doctors, nurses, social workers, and even people specializing in spiritual care. People with any serious illness, regardless of age, diagnosis, or stage of illness, can request palliative care, even if they're early in their treatment. And although it looks different at each hospital, hospitals are concerned about what the coronavirus pandemic means for their patients' access to this kind of care. For more on this, I spoke with Sunitha along with Arif Kamal, a palliative care researcher at the Duke University School of Medicine. Arif told me that even before COVID-19, there was a serious shortage of palliative care providers in the U.S.,
In the face of a coronavirus pandemic, we're particularly worried about both the availability and access of palliative care specialists, both in terms of the availability, knowing that there was already a shortage, but also access, recognizing that there are particular geographic deserts of palliative care in the United States. Particular states and particular regions have lower numbers of palliative care specialists, but we know that the pandemic will not discriminate based on the availability of palliative care, so we remain worried both in terms of the access and availability. And then secondarily, we also worry about the emotional health of palliative care clinicians as they're faced alongside other frontline clinicians with dealing with very complex and uncertain times. Palliative care clinicians are experts in counseling and dealing with uncertainty for sure. But in particular, we've never had to, as a field, face a situation where the patient and caregiver we're talking to may also present a personal health risk back to the clinicians that are involved. So for example, when we counsel patients with heart failure or cancer, we're not worried about getting heart failure or cancer by talking to them. But the field is high touch. We spend a lot of time with folks. We spend a lot of time in counseling. And a lot of that has to do with being close in proximity to patients and caregivers. Or now we are challenged with having to do that from a distance. We're challenged with sort of how this is affecting us, ourselves emotionally. And as some have said in the field, the distress in helping others is kind of like standing next to a waterfall and thinking you're not going to get wet. The challenge is that watching difficult things challenges us to not internalize that as a field. And so we have to remain both sort of physically available, but also emotionally available for these patients.
Sunitha, what will palliative care look like when it comes to those who fall ill due to this pandemic? Why is this form of care going to be so important?
I think it's going to be very important for several reasons. One, just in my experience taking care of patients and families more recently, everybody is really concerned that resource allocation or triage, or a term I don't like, rationing, is going to affect the care of their loved ones. And so there's a particular amount of anxiety that I've had to quell and questions that I've had to answer, reassuring people that the care of their particular loved one has nothing to do with the resource allocation issues that are, you know, important to consider, but not yet an issue at our particular hospital. Patients are already anxious about whatever illness they have. So it's an added stress, I think, for them to experience, for example, advanced cancer or end-stage heart failure or any other very serious illness in the context of this pandemic. I also think a big challenge that I've observed in my practice is that, generally speaking, so much of the art of palliative medicine is the human interaction between a patient, family, and physician. And now with the no visitor policy and the very strict restrictions on the number of physicians who can enter the room of a patient with COVID, I'm having to do these conversations remotely over Zoom or calls on the telephone. And it really prevents me, at least, from doing the full job that I'm capable of doing when I'm sitting in a room with patients and families. Nonetheless, I think palliative medicine is a key part of responding to this pandemic because the amount of suffering that patients, families, and providers are going to face is an issue that we are experts in helping people through.
Have you already begun to work with patients who are suffering from COVID?
Yes, we already have, and mainly the ICU patients, but also patients who might be very sick and not yet in the ICU. We are also having discussions with them about their care goals. We're also making sure their symptoms are under really good control. And I think for patients who ultimately their bodies show us that despite our best efforts in the ICU or elsewhere, that the disease is stronger than their bodies, then we step in at an even higher intensity to make sure that we're providing the best relief of suffering and symptoms like shortness of breath, for example, as the person goes through the dying process.
Arif, what might this health crisis mean for the role of palliative care in the future? Are you able to zoom out a little bit and give it some larger context?
I think palliative care will have a greater role in healthcare into the future. It will have to. And for those who weren't yet sure of its value, I think they're on the front lines now seeing exactly what palliative care does. I mean, the field has since its beginning really said, you know, watch us do what we do and then you'll understand how important we are to be around as much as possible. So, you know, we have a couple different ethos, right? One is we help everybody hope for the best while planning for the rest. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic really reminds us that we can remain hopeful for really good outcomes, but also that by acknowledging that the outcomes may be different than we would like, one, does not make them true, and two, actually is comforting to plan and be prepared for all the different contingencies that can happen. As I explained to my patients, I'm a professional worrier. I worry about the things that we can see and the things that we can't see, and we try to plan for them as best we can. You know, we as a field are very comfortable with uncertainty. We can see it in the eyes of patients and caregivers. We've been doing this for a while, where sometimes the answers are not known. Oftentimes the answers are not known, and the pandemic reminds us in particular that many answers to questions we wish we had, we are not able to answer. Uncertainty requires particular communication skills, moments of silence and reflection, empathic response, and lots of skills that palliative care clinicians are frankly experts at, both in terms of their own practice, but also helping other clinicians build those skills by teaching them the things that we know and simultaneously learning from them. In addition, the bigger change in healthcare will be more of a focus on having patients and caregivers and healthcare clinicians talk about the different things that we need to plan for into the future, regardless of whether there's a crisis or not. We call that advanced care planning or goals of care discussions. It's really understanding the values and preferences and what makes a person tick and what gives them a good day that we want to maximize as much as we can. And those conversations work better when they're not in a moment of crisis or when people are not facing an urgent decision.
So, Sunitha, regarding those conversations, how do you recommend people like me and our listeners start having those conversations about mortality and suffering all in the context of this pandemic? I think the phrase I refused was, hope for the best and plan for the rest. How do we do that?
That's a great question. And it's something that, you know, particularly Americans have a very hard time doing because death is still considered a taboo topic to consider and talk about. An advanced care planning discussion certainly involves thinking about what makes your life meaningful, who and what is important to you in your life. If you were to get very sick, what sorts of medical interventions might you want for yourself? Specifically around things like CPR, which involves when somebody goes through a cardiac arrest and their heart stops, would they want to go through chest compressions, electric shocks, and all the other elements of resuscitation that we generally perform? And what outcome would they be hoping for? And I think one of the most important parts of advanced care planning is designating who would be your voice if you were too sick to advocate for yourself. And in that regard, I encourage people to ask, who would I want to be my voice? And who would I not want involved in advanced care planning? And I think some of the specific questions that people should ask themselves are some of the ones I already said. And I think they should ask their doctors for input as well. I recently spoke with my own parents again about their wishes in the context of COVID. And I opened it by saying something really simple, which was just, you know, mom and dad, we're now in the midst of something that I worry that you might be at risk for. I know we've talked about your wishes before, and I hate to bring this up again, but I really do want to know what you would want for yourself if you were to get really sick, because I want to be the best voice for you. I want to advocate for what you would want for yourself and not have to make decisions in a moment of emotion. And I think what Arif said is exactly right, that when we don't have these conversations, when we are clear of mind and we're talking with the people we love, then we put a great burden on the people we love and on our physicians to make decisions, often in the setting of an emergency or crisis. So having these discussions, as challenging and as emotional as they might be, are really important to do for the sake of your loved ones and your physicians as well, and for you, because you don't want those people to be guessing about what you might or might not want. I've been in so many situations where families say to me, "We just didn't talk about it, and I really don't know what input to give you." Right. And that might be a patient suffering from cancer for years. And so the earlier we have these discussions, the better off so many people will be, and so many people suffering will be relieved if we have the courage to do them early.
Sunitha Puri is the Director of Palliative Medicine at the Keck Hospital and Norris Cancer Center of the University of Southern California. And Arif Kamal is a palliative care researcher at the Duke University School of Medicine. Thank you both for your work and for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the last several weeks, we've been checking in with communities across continents about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting life. We now go to India, where the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 has remained relatively low for its population, which is among the largest in the world. For the first few weeks of the pandemic, the Indian government took steps to close down the border and restrict movement in the country. Starting last week, the state ordered a nationwide lockdown, leading its economy to spiral downward. Locking down a country with one of the world's largest populations is a giant logistical problem, and many people throughout the country are suffering as a result. For more on this, I'm joined by Karen Singh, a reporter for the New York Times based in New Delhi, and Sanjeev Miglani, the Reuters bureau chief in New Delhi. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Thank you for having us.
Karen, how is the lockdown of such a large population being enforced? Are people following the orders to stay home?
Well, when you say a lockdown in India, that means 1.3 billion people who've been asked to stay at home.
It's a mind-boggling number.
Yeah, it's nearly a fifth of humanity. And we've seen it play out in various ways. The lockdown might help curb the spread of the virus, but it has brought life and the country's economy to a grinding halt. So that's put millions of Indians out of work and left families hungry.
Are people actually then staying in their homes? They're not working. There's hunger. And so what are they doing? What do the streets look like?
When you ask such a large population to stay at home, we have to understand that not all of them are able to stay at home because of the kind of jobs they do. India has 470 million workers who work in the informal sector. And that means these are vegetable vendors. These are people who run carts with, you know, all kinds of things. These are stone cutters, people who work as maids in people's houses. They typically earn their livelihood by going out of their homes, and they live in places that are densely populated. These are crowded slums where people live 10 to a room a lot of times. And social distancing is not just difficult, it's nearly impossible in these places.
Sanjeev, until recently, Prime Minister Narendra Modi had resisted a national lockdown. So what changed?
Yeah, I think then they saw the reality. I mean, like many other countries, India was also slow to react at the beginning and looked at it and said it's a China problem. And I think we were slow, but then they moved very decisively when the numbers started to look at, stare them in the face. I mean, like Karan mentioned, this is a, you know, this is a country of 1.3 million people. The health systems are not, are nowhere near the standards that are there in several countries in the West. As it is, India has a very low percentage of doctors. We've got something like one doctor for about, I think, 2,000 people, as opposed to the World Bank thing for about one per 1,000. And there are parts of India, there are even, it's worse. So this is, wow. If it blows up in the way it has blown up in other countries, it would clearly overwhelm the structure here. And so I think we are at this stage where they're trying to sort of stem it, keep it off for the next 3 weeks. I mean, this is the world's largest lockdown, and then hoping that it'll sort of blow over. They'll be able to get some systems going in the hospitals. I mean, they're starting to prepare stadiums and train railway coaches to sort of house people. I mean, that's where they are. This is going to, we don't know what it's going to look like on April 15 when this lifts.
Yeah.
But that's the hope is that they might have sort of reduced the numbers by doing this kind of lockdown that has been quite painful, as Karan mentioned, for a lot of people.
Karan, an unintended effect of the lockdown was that it triggered thousands of laborers to migrate back to their home villages. And I've seen images of this migration. Apparently, the government only gave about a four-hour warning before the lockdown. How did that work? How did everyone get home?
Well, these people are walking. They're walking for several hundred kilometers on foot. They're carrying their children on their bags. They're carrying their luggage, their food with them. And it's we've already seen at least 22 migrants who died while trying to attempt this journey back home. And I think it's important to understand why people are feeling so helpless. It's because they're attempting these journeys, risking their lives at the time of a global pandemic, because what they fear more is starving, not coronavirus.
So why couldn't they stay wherever they had stayed in the cities? Why did they have to try this long journey back home?
They've been furloughed from their jobs. They've basically been told by their employers that this is it. We don't know when we can call you back for your jobs, and you're not going to be paid. They've been told by the people who take rent from them for these tiny apartments, tenements, really, that they live in, you should go. We will not be able to give you the house for any longer because you can't pay. These are people who live paycheck to paycheck. And when we say, you know, these are informal workers who work in the sector that accounts for nearly 80% of the country's exports. So you're talking things like IKEA carpets that are made, you know, in India, things made from leather, all kinds of things. These are the people making them. India's economy runs on these people.
Is the government doing anything to address these issues involving the migrants in terms of their lack of food and their problems with the travel, Karan? Is there anything going to change in that regard?
Yes. So till now, we've seen a very unexpected response from the government. There are some states where these migrants, initially, when they were trying to enter, they were being beaten up by the police. They were being told to go back. But there were some states who later decided to run buses for them. But that's a tiny percentage of people who will be accommodated in these buses. That's like about 100 buses in one of India's largest states. But there are people going from one corner of the country literally to the other. And it's not going to be enough because these people have no money on them. They have no food. Some have died of sheer exhaustion because of the kind of journey that they have decided to take on.
Wow. Sanjeev, tell us about the local response to the coronavirus in Kashmir. Are people there in lockdown as well?
People are locked down there as well. But Kashmir has an even more acute problem. They've been locked down for a long while. They've been locked down since August when the government in Delhi decided to change the status, you know, withdraw its autonomy, and they wanted to tighten the grip of the territory. which is, as you know, has been racked by a revolt running for 3 decades. So they wanted to quell it down. So they imposed controls. So the internet was stopped there in the beginning. People were detained. That has since been brought up again. But, you know, the speeds are way behind. They're like on 2G. So while the rest of India is under a lockout, for sure, we are all under a lockout and we can't step out. But we at least got the net going. I can talk. I can download stuff. I can work. But Kashmir is an almost like a digital black hole. I mean, I don't even know how much they know about how serious the coronavirus is, what kind of rumors are going on because of the sheer controls on the net there. The government doesn't want the net going fully because they fear that, you know, this can be used. It's been used in the past, they say, to sort of drum up protests and then people, you know, spill out into the streets and then it gets violent and the whole cycle begins. So that has always been a problem. So it's pretty frustrating for them.
Are the health officials in Kashmir feeling prepared, Sanjeev?
The health officials are also, I was speaking to a colleague of mine, the health officials are also struggling. They would like to do e-consulting the way people are trying to do other places. You know, if you don't have to come to the hospital for people, you know, and trying to tell them the difference between what's a common cold, what's corona, they would like to do that even for people down in the villages, sort of bring them up to speed. And, you know, simple things like even washing your hands and how do you do that? But they can't do that with this kind of speeds. I mean, the net is clearly restricting. The doctors have been complaining about this, you know, you are creating a problem that you'll, because we can't reach out to these people, they are going to try and come to the hospitals. And then, you know, that begins another cycle.
Karen, we know about the devastating effects that the virus has had on the economy in the U.S. And India already struggled with something of a weak economy. So how is the lockdown expected to impact India economically?
You know, just before the lockdown happened, India's economy was already weak and fragile. You know, some of the poorest people in India had gone back to 1 or 2 meals a day. People were not buying things like underwear, biscuits worth about 5 cents, even cars. They just didn't have enough jobs. So most Indians were tightening their wallets. With coronavirus, economists say that things have become much worse, that they've fallen off a cliff nearly. And this is because workers in the informal sector that the country's economy runs on have nowhere to go. There's no future for them because if they're not able to make a living, if the factories are shut, if they're not able to be on the streets doing their jobs, they have no way to earn. So no one will be able to spend because India's economy is basically, you know, it's been downgraded several times in the last week by rating agencies. India's economic growth has been projected as low as, you know, 3% by some economists.
Extraordinary times. Karen Singh is a staff writer for the New York Times, and Sanjeev Miglani is the Reuters bureau chief in New Delhi. Thank you to you both for your reporting and for sharing the news over there with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And we're rounding out the hour now with another installment of our comedy series, Joking from a Distance. Our next guest, comedian Dan Adut, has been doing stand-up comedy for roughly 2 decades now, and he hosts the food podcast Green Eggs and Dan. He's also, and this isn't on his IMDb page for some reason, one of my oldest and best friends in the world, and the funniest guy I know. So I got him on the line this week to talk.
Hello, Matthew.
Oh, hello, Daniel.
How are
you? Thanks for joining us. I'm good.
Thank you for having me.
Dan's been social distancing by staying with his parents in his childhood home on Long Island. And before the coronavirus outbreak began, he was filming episodes of his new Netflix show, The Crew, with Kevin James. I asked him what it was like to put his dream job on hold for the coronavirus.
You know, I think that as a stand-up comedian, we just spend our whole lives hustling and waiting for these opportunities. And the hustle in between can be really just degrading work. I mean, Matt, you saw me perform at a ground round in Philadelphia years ago.
Yes, it did.
So these opportunities, when you get these opportunities, they're very, very few and far between, and the chances of them actually going on air are even more minuscule. So to actually get cast on a show that is going to air, it's like winning the lottery like twice in a row.
In the weeks since the show got put on hold, you've been living with your parents on Long Island instead of in Los Angeles, where your girlfriend is. Now, your parents are lovely people, but why are you quarantined with your parents? What's going on? Why are you living back in your high school bedroom?
I'll tell you the truth. My parents were not taking this seriously enough when it started. And I was one of those psychos running around like, you know, the British are coming, and no one was listening to me. And everyone was telling me I was crazy, especially my parents. And when I found out, and this is like after like the self-isolation orders were going on and this and that, I found out that my parents wanted to make a chicken soup and they had two chickens in the freezer, but my dad went to the supermarket because they needed a smaller chicken. Okay? They needed a smaller freaking chicken. And this is in Great Neck, New York, where it's already become kind of a hotspot. And he goes to the supermarket, and apparently someone sneezed in the supermarket, and he ran out. I'm like, all right, you guys need some supervision. So I'm literally here as their prison guard. I don't let them out. I let them if there's good behavior, I'll let them out for like, you know, 20 minutes to walk around the backyard. My dad literally made a run for it once when I took a shower. I took a shower and I come out and my dad wasn't in the house. It's crazy. It's crazy.
This is like you sneaking out in high school to go visit your girlfriend at like midnight.
I'm yelling at my 79-year-old dad. How dare you leave the house? How dare you leave your own house?
So the good thing about living with your parents is you're able to mine them for material, and often without them even knowing. And poking fun of your immigrant parents has always been a central part of your comedy. And then finally, last month, you had a tweet involving what it's like to be quarantined with your parents. And this tweet went haywire. Set the scene.
Yeah. We are currently binging Homeland. My parents had never seen Homeland, one of my favorite shows. And in season one, there's a scene where Carrie Matheson is having pretty gratuitous sex. And I happened to have my phone on while there was the sex scene going on. And I basically shot from the sex scene to my parents sitting there just nonchalant to me, mortified, because, you know, there's really nothing more mortifying than watching a sex scene with your parents. And I posted it, you know, under like hashtag quarantine life. And man, I can't even track what the flame was that got this going. But within a day, it had 1 million views. Within 2 days, it was at 3 million. And within about a week, it's at around 8 million views right now. It's been retweeted by members of parliament. It's been retweeted by like Bollywood stars. Like, I'm getting messages from all over the world. It is amazing to me how much people can relate to that moment.
They can relate to it. And these are such dark times that people are desperate to laugh, right? I mean, people just want a break.
You know, I'm getting a lot of that in the messages. Like, thank you so much for giving me a break and for giving me a laugh.
Overall, how productive have you been in terms of your writing, in terms of your comedy, while you're living in your boyhood bedroom over there?
Pretty productive. I think I'm going to turn my bedroom into a little studio and shoot this show that I've been wanting to shoot for a while. You probably know about it, but it's just doing a clip show, which is just making fun of all the food shows out there. And I feel like actually do that. Yeah. So I can actually do that from my childhood bedroom. And I think I'm going to make it happen.
Are there any jokes that you've come up with while living at home that you'd be willing to share with us right now? As long as it's funny and relatively clean and doesn't embarrass me.
I don't know. Just how like in the future, you know, no one's going to be able to cough in public. You're just going to have to convert all your coughs into laughs. Like, I'm just laughing.
Right.
We're all just going to be holding in our sneezes until like our insides explode.
Right. Well, everybody can find you on the socials. You're at StandUpDan everywhere. Your food podcast is Green Eggs and Dan. And Dan Adut is one of the stars of the upcoming Netflix show, The Crew. It's great talking to you, Dan. Send my love to your folks. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Matt. Bye-bye.
Well, we just heard how comedian Dana Dude has tried to find some humor in trying to protect his elderly parents during this pandemic. And many of you have been telling us that you're worried about your parents or other loved ones in this moment as well.
Hi, this is Sylvia Clemente calling from Eureka in northern Humboldt County, California. I live with my 80-year-old mother, Jane. She was diagnosed with a foot injury right before the pandemic really hit the U.S. So she would have normally and was initially not respecting doctor's orders to keep off her foot, but then the shelter-in-place order came down from the governor, and so she's actually had to follow doctor's orders and yield to her better health. However, I think this has added to her restlessness and helplessness. She and I are now in the exacerbated role reversal of caregiver and care receiver.
Hello, this is Tony Buscemi from Lake Oswego, Oregon. My dad's in a retirement center, and they've had them locked down in Vancouver, Washington for several weeks. He stays in his room. They bring food to him, and his only communication with the outside world is when we call him. And so we need to just keep reaching out often so that they know we love them and we miss them.
Thank you all for sharing with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And I'm signing off for today. It's been a pleasure hosting this week. Thank you so much for trusting us and engaging with us every day. Starting next week, I'll be passing off the mic to Lizzie O'Leary, who will also be guest hosting from her home. Before I go, quick shout out to the team that makes this show each and every day. Our senior producer is Alexandra Boti, and our producer team is Ethan Oberman, Amber Hall, Patricia Jacob, Jackie Martin, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Jake Howitt is our director. Jose Olivares is line producing. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Katarina Barton is our intern. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is our executive producer. Back at the station this week, holding down the fort, our board operator and sound engineers Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry, with Vince Fairchild directing. We appreciate you all of the time, and particularly right now. You can find me on Twitter at MattKatz00. That's Matt, K-A-T-Z, 00. This is The Takeaway.